is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
If you're just not going to listen and not do what we're trying to do to get us to win, then we'll just go get somebody who will do those things.
Trey Morin is entering his first season as the boys basketball program director and head coach at St. Andrew's School in Austin, Texas. Morin was previously the head boys basketball coach at the Phelps School in Malvern, Pennsylvania. During his two seasons, 15 of his seniors went on to play collegiate basketball at various levels. Prior to his time at Phelps, Morin served as an assistant coach at Bates College in the prestigious NESCAC Conference, arguably the best combination of athletics and academics in the country. Morin has also served as an assistant coach at Colby Sawyer College and Bradford Christian Academy. Trey played 4 years of varsity basketball at Salem State in Salem, Massachusetts, and was team captain as a senior. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Dan Evans, head men's basketball coach at the University of North Georgia, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Be ready to jot down some notes as you listen to this episode with Trey Morin, head boys basketball coach at St. Andrew's School in Austin, Texas. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to welcome Trey Morin, head coach at St. Andrew's School in Austin, Texas, to the Hoopheads pod. We have hooked up in person at Snow Valley. It is great to have you on the podcast. At long last, we're probably 2 years overdue, Trey, but welcome.
Thanks, guys. I'm super excited to do this. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, so I'm excited to get this going.
There you go. We are going to dive into all the things that you've been able to do in the game, work our way up to you getting a new job at St. Andrews, talk about what you're planning to do to build the program there. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us about your first experiences with the game of basketball. What are some of your earliest memories?
Man, I think, like a lot of young kids my age, I think the first thing I kind of really remember and resonates with me is Space Jam. I probably watched Space Jam 100 times on loop, reenacting the intro and stuff in my living room. And I love Michael Jordan and I love Patrick Ewing. And I just, it's something that really got me into it.
What about Space Jam 2, Trey?
I watched like 20 minutes of it, man. And I was like, you know what? This is not for me. I'm sure the kids love it. I love LeBron, but I couldn't get behind.
I didn't get more than 20 minutes either, Trey. So we're in the same company there.
I stopped at the Warner Brothers pitch. And I don't know, man. I don't know if this is for me.
I got to tell you, Trey, this might be the earliest Jason has ever jumped in on an episode since COVID started. So you went right to the heart of what gets him going. So he's been telling me about Space Jam 2. I'll be honest. I love Michael Jordan. I have never watched the original Space Jam. I've never watched it. And Jason's been talking about this version of Space Jam for, it feels like
10 years, he's been telling me how great it's going to be and when it's going to come out and the trailer and this and that. And
I never said it was going to be great. Like, I never said it was going to be great.
You've been touting it for a long time.
I've been saying that everything that LeBron's doing was because of Space Jam. I said that he was going. Listen, Mike, you want to go back? I've got the tapes. We can all go back right. 3 years when I said right. I said he's going to the Los Angeles Lakers, and you was like, no, why would he go there? I was like, because he's going to make that stupid Space Jam movie. And then what happened?
Right, well, he went to the Lakers and made that stupid. You put a lot of time in on studying the twists and turns in the Space Jam 2. So at any rate, yeah, I could see where anything Michael Jordan related to get you inspired with the game of basketball resonates with me for sure, Trey. Let's put it that way.
Love it.
All right. So Space Jam, Michael Jordan, you start getting into the game. When did you start to take it more seriously where it became something that you knew you wanted to focus on as a young athlete?
Yeah, I think like a lot of kids too, with me growing up, I played three sports. I played baseball, football, and basketball until I was probably like in seventh grade. And I had a big growth spurt. I think I went from like 5'8", 5'9", to like 6'4", 6'5". And, you know, I kind of like wasn't good. I wasn't a great athlete growing up. Like I wasn't one of these kids that was like, you know, you pick something up and you're automatically really good at it. And in seventh grade, I tried out for like the way our town system worked was there was a house league, which was kind of like rec. And then there was like the travel. And I got cut from the traveling team in seventh grade. I didn't play hard. Like there was a lot of, I wasn't very good. But the travel coach was also my rec league coach. So I had to like see him every day. Right. And, you know, he basically told me along with my dad, like, listen, you can let this like derail you or you can get better. And that summer going into my eighth grade year, I really, really, really started to take it serious. I started, you know, reworking my shot. I'd watch like Ray Allen shoot and kind of tried to shoot like him in terms of like his mechanics and stuff. And just really, started to take it more seriously. I started doing it every day, because my goal was to be good enough the way our high school was structured. We were 7 through 12. You could be on JV in eighth grade. So my goal was to make JV in eighth grade, and I'm happy to say that happened. So I didn't have to play travel. Yeah. So like, you know, and I grew a little bit. I was, you know, 6'6", 6'7", and had gotten better and things like that. So it was, you know, seventh grade is when I really started to be like, okay, like I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to, you know, I'm blessed with this size. I'm going to try to make something out of it.
What's your favorite memory from your high school career?
So we had a very kind of average high school program. It's not a very big town in Western Massachusetts. It's actually in the same league that Liz Kay is on in. So you had her as a guest, obviously. So, you know, we won the South County Championship, which is like our league. And then we made it to the Western Mass Cage, which is like, if you're from Massachusetts, that's a pretty big deal. It's where UMass used to play. It's, I guess, basically the district semifinals and finals are there. So we made it there. It was a big deal for our town, and you know, the whole town kind of came out, and that's what I remember most.
I think it's cool when you do get a community, especially those smaller communities where you get people that the entire town kind of gets behind the team, and you think about what it's like to play and coach in that environment, even when you're in a small gym and it's packed. The ability to be able to play or coach in that kind of environment, I think, is something that, well, none of us have experienced it now for 18 months, let's put it that way. But even under normal circumstances, I just don't think you see – there are still some pockets, I think, in the country where you've got that kind of support for high school sports. But I think in a lot of places, you just don't see the same level of A, community support, like people who are just folks in the community who just show up for games because they like watching the high school team. I think you still get that a little bit with football, but basketball – doesn't feel like you get like that. And then certainly, at least when I think back to my experiences, especially my experience as a player and then early in my coaching career, I think about the number of students that showed up for games. And it just doesn't seem like it's that way in as many places as it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. So when and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but when we would recruit at a lot of the colleges, I was at, obviously you go to a lot of games. And primarily at one of my spots, I would go recruit like independent schools, like most people would call it prep school.
Right.
And they all have activities during the same time that like the basketball games go on. So like there's nobody there. right? It's like a parent, it's a couple college coaches, or, you know, maybe some faculty or whatever. And then I went to a New Jersey public school game, and they had crazy, it was crazy in there. And I remember, I'll never forget this. I walked in and I was like, this is what a high school basketball game is like. I mean, the place was packed. It was around Christmas. So like kids were dressed like Santa Claus. It was wild. It was great. And I just remember distinctly being like, that was kind of the moment that I was like, I want to go back to high school. Like, this is it, you know?
Yeah, those environments are so much fun. Like I said, when you think about playing in front of or coaching in front of a packed house, and it doesn't matter if it's a little tiny gym that seats 600 people, if it's full and people are banging off the walls and people are climbing on top of each other and dressed like Santa Claus and all the other crazy stuff that kids will tend to do, it just makes it so much more fun to play and coach in that environment than in the other one that you described, where you basically have some parents and you got maybe one or two teachers and that's pretty much it. And we've all unfortunately been having to experience that with COVID for the last couple of months. I think about primarily myself as a player. I remember one time we went and played at a tournament in Iona, right outside New York City. Mm-hmm. And I think this was when I was a sophomore, I think. And we were playing the first game and Iona was playing in the second game. And Iona had a really tiny gym at that point. And I remember our game, it was like my parents and seriously like four other people in the gym for that game. And I'm looking around going, is this really a college basketball game? Like, this is just bizarre. And I mean, I played in front of some other small crowds too, don't get me wrong, but you're just like, this is like a scrimmage. It's not even, there's more people watching me play at the Y when I go up and just play pickup games, just people waiting to get in the game. So it's funny how different places have, you know, still are kind of holding on to that tradition of community support and whatever. And then other places, it seems like it's gone away just because people have so much other stuff that they can be doing. Kids can, you know, you sit on your phone or you got video games or whatever. It just seems like there isn't that same sense of community that there was in the past, at least not in a lot of places.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So when you're wrapping up your high school career, when does college basketball get on your radar that you'd like to continue playing in your career? At what point do you make the decision that, hey, I'd like to be able to play in college if I can? And then describe a little bit of what you remember of your recruitment, what that was like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I always had a goal. I think I floated a little bit on varsity as a freshman, but I think my sophomore year I kind of was the main focus of the team. And that's actually when I started to be like, okay, like I think I can play in college. Like I have a prerequisite, right? Like I was like 6'7 or 6'8. Like I have something that people want. And now all I have to do is be good enough to kind of make it. And I think like a lot of kids, like I wanted to play Division I, I wanted to do this, I wanted to do that. But, you know, I've always been pretty self-aware. Like when I was growing up playing baseball, like I knew I was bad at baseball. I wasn't like one of these kids that was like, oh yeah, I'm going to the major leagues. I'm like, I'm terrible. I can't even get a hit a year. So, you know, I started to see where certain kids were going in our league and I was like, okay, that kid's going here and that kid's going there. Like, I think I'm better than that kid, but I'm not as good as that guy. So like, you know, you start to kind of piece yourself out and you're playing AU and, you know, probably like my recruitment really started to pick up my junior year. I was hearing from every different level, Division I all the way down to Division III in some junior colleges. And I kind of was really overwhelmed by the process, to be honest with you. I didn't have a lot of guidance. Neither of my parents really knew very much about college. They both went to college for a period of time, but weren't like, you know, there wasn't the guidance counseling and all this stuff. So I kind of was just, you know, instead of taking visits and doing things that other kids were doing, like I was basically choosing where I could play from the schools that had contacted me and we knew were serious. You know, I started taking visits and things like that. And eventually it got to be, and this was still in the day of like mass mailing from schools. So like I would get letters every day from all these different schools. And I just eventually was just like, you know what? Like, I really want this to be over with. Like, I don't like all this attention. I don't like them calling me. Like, it's a 40-year-old man and me talking on the phone. Like, what are we going to talk about at some point? So I've always kind of, you know, put that in my back pocket when I'm recruiting in terms of my approach to it. But, you know, I decided pretty early. I think, you know, I went to a small school in Salem, Massachusetts, Salem State University, which, you know, I wanted to go somewhere where they were going to win. Because I kind of knew, like, listen, I'm probably not going to play overseas. Like, let's just go somewhere where even if I don't play right away, we're going to win. Because again, it was very average high school program. I wanted to be a part of something that we were going to win games, and we did that. And I thought it was good. But I decided like probably September or October to go to Salem, which is really, really early for that program. They, you know, they're still getting kids in July and August.
Absolutely. So did that take a little bit of the edge or the pressure off you as a senior, and you had maybe more of a, I don't know if enjoyable is the right word, but you just didn't have all that stuff floating around thinking about it? Did it make your senior year more enjoyable as a high school player?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even as a student, right? Like you go and like all these kids, and you see it today. I mean, you guys work in schools. Like you see it today, like all these, it's like a pressure cooker of like where they're going to go to college. And, you know, I knew it was the right place for me at that time in my life. Like I said, it's not like I didn't have options. I think it was just, you know, when I got on campus, I knew that's where I wanted to be. And I kind of made that decision, but I definitely remember feeling a lot less stressed out. Like I didn't have to do, you know, all the kind of stuff that a lot of the kids have to do in terms of visits and applications and all that stuff. Like the after Salem, I'm pretty sure was like a half a page essay and just the application. So I was like, sold.
Check it off, man. We're done. We're done. Where do I sign?
Yeah, for
no, that's
sure.
Good. That's a great story. I mean, there's obviously a lesson to be learned there. I think that you mentioned it, and I think it rings true for me as when I think back to my time as a player. I think it rings true for most of what you see out there is that kids who are taking the game seriously, so many of them have that dream of playing Division I basketball. And yet we talk to so many coaches that they really talk about how important it is to find the right fit. And you have to find a place that you're going to be happy going to school. You got to find a place where you're going to be happy socially. You got to find a place that fits your talent level. As you said, you have to be realistic about what your talent level is. And I think that's getting harder and harder for kids to be able to do because of A, just the amount of parents that are involved in it. And then you think about social media and what kids are seeing every day. I think it's hard to have the kind of outlook that you had where you're just like, look, I want to be able to be in a place where you had some clear criteria of what you were looking for, it seems, and then you were able to make a clear-headed decision. It sounds like it ended up being a good one. What was your transition like from high school to college, both on the basketball floor and just as a student and just going from being at home in high school to being away and being at college?
Yeah, I mean, I'll touch on the student thing first. I've never been the best student in the world. I think I'll say that. But actually, college is a little bit easier, right? You have a little bit more free time. There's a little bit more like subjects you're interested in. I wasn't being forced to read, you know, X English book that I really could care less about at the time. So, you know, I really enjoyed it. I mean, you know, obviously the social aspect of like getting to know people is not the easiest thing in the world. It was a much bigger school than my high school. My high school had like 300 kids in it, and Salem State has like 6,000 kids. So it's a lot bigger. So the student aspect and the social aspect, I kind of figured it out, and I had a little bit more time to do my work and things like that. And kind of apply myself to subjects I'm interested in. But basketball, it's always interesting, right? Like, almost every conversation I've had with potential recruits or kids that we want to bring into our program is like, you know, you got to kind of get in where you fit in. And I went from basically playing every minute of every game I played in since I was a sophomore to like not playing at all, right? Like I was behind a kid that was a two-time All-American, three-time player of the year, just the probably, if not the best player in program history, definitely in the conversation. You know, and just, it was a lot different. I mean, the kids were big, strong, fast. It's a really good program. It's a really proud program. But I was excited to kind of get behind that and learn and things like that. But the adjustment was tough on the basketball court. Like the game's a lot faster. The guys are, you know, I remember my coach saying like, you know, all these guys look like you now. So like, you have to do something besides be big, right? Like, they're looking you in the eye. They can move too. They can meet you at the rim too. So I think, you know, that adjustment's always tough, but I think to my credit, I never thought about transferring anything like that. I always wanted to be a part of the program that was going to win.
Was it that desire to be part of a winning program that enabled you to make the mental adjustment and be able to handle the fact that you went from sort of a big fish in a small pond to a small fish in a bigger pond? Do you think it's just that you went into it knowing that, hey, you wanted to win and you were realistic about where you fit in? Is that what helped you to be able to accept and adjust and not look for greener pastures and try to think about transferring out? How do you remember your mindset at that point, your freshman year?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, through the recruiting process and even when they were watching me, like, I think the staff thought I was going to play. I don't feel like they were lying to me. I mean, I still have a really good relationship with my college coach. Like, I think it was just, you know, I always joke with him, like, it's probably the biggest miss eval in his career. Like, I think they thought I was going to play, and they thought, yeah, because I'm pretty skilled. I'm big. I can do a lot of things. It's just, I think that I'm not very athletic, so I think the speed really hurt. And I think I just knew, right? Like, when you're getting just, like, you know you can't guard the dude that's playing over you, and he's getting triple teamed in the game, and he's scoring 30 and, like, not even really breaking a sweat, like, that guy's probably better than you. So, like, why don't you just do something else and clap, right? Like, and I really enjoyed going to school there. I really enjoyed the team. It's a very diverse school. I know that's, like, kind of a buzzword now, but it's very, like, it's really a melting pot of a bunch of different places and a bunch of different people, primarily all from Massachusetts. So I really enjoyed it. The team atmosphere was great. You know, we were winning. So, you know, my mental, like, I wanted to play. I worked really hard in practice. I actually, like, I'm pretty sure stopped doing the in-season lift and was just like, listen, I'm just going to try to get as strong as I can, and kind of started doing my own lift to try to get better. And I kind of just reverted back to seventh grade. Like, either you can kind of complain and bury your head in the sand and moan about not doing this, or you can make it work. And, you know, I tried to make it work as best I could.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lesson there that anybody who's a player out there that's listening, you could certainly take from that, which is, you know, sometimes you get in a situation where it sounds like, other than you getting minutes on the basketball floor, it sounds like this was pretty much a perfect scenario for what you were looking for in an experience as a school. And as you said, being a part of a winning basketball program. And I think it takes a strong mind to be able to look at that and say, hey, I can figure out how to make this work, even though this one piece of what I was hoping to get out of it, I'm not getting out of it at the moment, but there's so many other good things around me that I'm figuring out a way to make it work. And I think so often today, and we can take it all the way down to youth basketball, where kids kind of jump from, oh, it's not working out here, and now I'm going on to the next team, or this coach isn't treating me right, or this program is the wrong program for me, even though I just signed up for it 2 months ago and I'm jumping to this new place. And I think it would be great if we had more people that would kind of put their head down and realize that, hey, if I just work hard, that my opportunities are going to come if I've made that, you know, if I've done my due diligence up front. And it's not that you never end up in a wrong situation, because obviously that certainly can happen, and not telling people they should stay in a bad spot. But I think too many kids today, when you look at the transfer portal and just all the stuff that's going on, even at the high school level, transferring schools, I think so many people are chasing that green grass on the other side of the fence that they just don't stop and look at what they already have and try to make the best of that situation, which often ends up turning out to be a positive for the people who do stay, like it did for you. When you first got to school, Trey, what did you want to study? What did you think you were going to do as a career? Kind of where was your mindset at there? Were you thinking coaching when you first went to school, or where were you at with that?
So I don't remember how old I was. I just remember, like, getting something out of the attic with my dad and, like, being like, hey, you know, does Mike Krzyzewski, like, is that his job? Is that what he gets paid to do? You know, my dad, like, looking at me and be like, yeah. I was like, he's a basketball coach? Like, he gets paid to do that? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, all right, well, that's what I want to do, right? So probably I met this guy. This is, like, such a divine intervention thing. I went to this, like, I was already on an AU team, but I wanted to, like, get a workout in. So I went to this, like, random workout in Springfield, which is, like, 45 minutes from my house, of another team. And I knew the coach. I was like, hey, I'm just going to come by. Like, you mind? No. And there was this guy. His name's Tommy Riddell. And he instantly just kind of drew me in. And I was like, this is my guy. You know, like, this guy's got juice. He knows what he's talking about. Blah, 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 blah. And eventually we developed a relationship. I was probably 14 or 15 this time. And we developed a relationship. And I told him, I said, hey, listen, man, I think I want to do this. Like, I think I want to coach. And fortunate enough for me, he kind of just liked me for whatever reason, right? And just kind of took me under my wing, under his wing, sorry, and was like, you know, this is kind of the steps you need to take. These are, you know, how people kind of break into this, but you got to know, you got to set yourself up, dude. Like, you ain't going to make any money for the first 5 or 6 years that you do this. He's like, your name ain't Patino, you know, like, you ain't going to do that. So you got to try to figure it, set yourself up. So, I always knew I wanted to coach, to answer your first thing. I think from the time I was probably 7 or 8, I always knew that. And then the second kind of caveat of why I wanted to study what I studied was Pete Zanella, who used to be the head coach at Fairleigh Dickens for the women. Now he's an assistant at Seton Hall. He's from the town I went to high school in. He told me, I asked him, I said, what do coaches usually study? And he goes, whatever you can get a job after you get fired doing. So I was like, all right. So I walked into like the advisor for a freshman year. And I was like, I want to coach, but I got to get something that if I get fired, I can do. And so I ended up studying political science because she was like, this is pretty broad. You know, and it gives you a lot of different avenues, and you're crazy for wanting to be a basketball coach. But, you know, I really enjoyed it. And I've been really lucky. I've had a lot of older heads around me that have really kind of helped me through this as most successful young coaches have.
So as you're growing up and you're playing, did you consciously think about and sort of watch and observe your coaches, the coaches you played for, to kind of get a feel for what coaching was all about? In other words, were you kind of watching the game not only through the eyes of a player, but were you starting to think about it at all through the eyes of a coach, or did that not really fully happen until after your playing career was over?
I think so. Through high school, I was just worried about, you know, getting buckets. Like, you know what I mean? I just want to score every time I touch it. So like, you know, even though I morphed into much more of like, you know, a catch it to pass it kind of guy. You know, through high school, I did off the floor, I guess is the best way to put it. I watched, you know, Big Monday. I watched, you know, Big 12 Tuesday or whatever they call it. I watched a lot of basketball. I think that's something that's really helped me is, you know, I listened to the announcers. I just tried to soak in as much as I could. And then honestly, like when I got to college and I wasn't playing a lot, like I tried to add value wherever I could. So if I saw something, like I always tried to help the people that were playing ahead of me, you know, especially when I was young, and sometimes they'd listen to me, sometimes they wouldn't, but you know, I'd always be kind of talking to some of the seniors on the bench about what they see and things like that. And, so probably 50-50, definitely once I got to college, cause I kind of knew I started coaching AAU when my freshman year of college, and started to kind of see the game through that lens. But you're always, I mean, if you're into it, you're always trying to figure out how to get a leg up on the other team.
Absolutely. So what were your AAU? What were those first coaching experiences like in AAU for you? What did you like about it instantaneously? Because before it had kind of been sort of a nebulous idea where you're playing and you're like, hey, I'd like to be a coach someday. But now once you actually start coaching, what's an aspect of it that you really enjoyed right from the get-go?
I think coaching with Tommy. So Tommy brought me on. We coached this program called the Rhode Island Hawks, which is no longer around. But it was – I don't know if it was the first, but they were all high academic kids. So it was kind of a niche market, right? And I just really enjoyed how much I could help the athletes. So we had a 1700 team. I was an assistant. I would just kind of do whatever he needed me to do. But the kids would always try to say like, okay, well, you're in college. Like, how do I get there? Right. And I think I thought coaching was a lot about like, you know, drawing plays and things like that. But you know, probably halfway through that first season of coaching, I realized like, that's not what this is about. This is about helping these kids kind of get to where they want to get to. You know, whether it's, you know, we had kids go to Colgate and Harvard and things like that, but like whether it's there or another avenue, I think that's the piece that's always really stuck with me is in the forefront of my mind is how do I help this student get from where they are to where they want to be or as close to where they want to be as I can.
That's really cool. Cause I think a lot of times when you think about young coaches, or I think about myself, I kind of went into it with the sort of the same experience that you had prior to getting into it, where you think it's mostly about my basketball knowledge and I used to think it's about my skill as a player and I can translate that. And you quickly, I think, come to realize that, yeah, that's a part of it. But so much of what you do is, as you describe, you're building a relationship with your players, and then that relationship allows you to impact their life positively through something that we all love, through the game of basketball. I think that's what makes coaching so special, is that you get to be able to have those interactions within the framework of, you know, a game that you've been playing since you were 4 or 5 years old. To me, that's what's really, really fun about it. And not everybody always gets to, you know, I think sometimes it takes a little bit of time to get to that realization, because at the beginning of, I know my career, it was kind of more about me and trying to figure out who I was and what I was all about. And I think back to the first couple teams I coached, and I'm not sure that I was probably the best coach for those kids, because I was more focused on me than them, instead of, you know, eventually that focus tended to flip where now you are more focused on the kids and what you can do for them as opposed to vice versa, which is kind of how it was there early in my career. When you think about finishing up and you graduate and now you start looking for a job, tell me what that first job hunt was like, and you end up getting a GA job. Is that the first, that's the first position that you got coming out of Salem State, correct?
Yeah. So it's funny, like I was kind of half in, half out. So I knew I wanted to do it, but I really didn't honestly listen to Tommy as much as I should have.
You looked at that paycheck, you were like, I'm not sure this is what I want to do.
So like I could, and this is like probably still my biggest regret today in my career. And it's, you know, a regret is, you know, it just, cause I didn't get to coach him. I had a GA with him where I could go work with him at his college that he was at. And it was like, if you think about the middle of nowhere in Vermont, that's what it was. Like the closest store is 30 minutes away and, you know, there's nothing around, or I could go do, sort of like athletic operations. So, you know, order buses and do game management and kind of just be around it at Merrimack. So I actually didn't coach basketball at Merrimack. I just kind of hung around the basketball staff and avoided doing work with the athletic department as much as I can. And, you know, I'd go to class and it was a year program. So it was super accelerated. They paid for me to go. It's a great experience, but it wasn't like as fulfilling as maybe I at the time thought it was. But it had a ton of translatable skills, right? Like dealing with coaches, dealing with athletes, trying to learn how to plan logistics stuff, you know, scheduling and things like that. And I kind of maybe didn't appreciate it as much at the time, but that was my first kind of foray. And the work of school was a lot for me to balance because it was, I mean, I think it was literally like a 10-month program. You got a master's degree. So it was like it was crazy. It was four classes. You're working 40 hours a week. It was a lot, but I'm really happy I did it.
When you think back to that time, some of those skills that you learned, even though you weren't working directly with the basketball program, I'm sure that some of those skills have served you well in the positions that you've gone on to hold. I think about you as a head coach at a prep school. I'm sure that a lot of those same tasks that you were doing as a GA there at Merrimack are things that you're still doing today, I would guess, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, I think that probably prepared – this is funny. Like, that probably prepared me to be a good Division III assistant more than anything I did. Because, you know, at the Division III level, like, you just do everything. If you're fortunate enough to have a manager or an intern or, like, another part-time guy, like, they can help out with some. But if it's a part-time guy, right, he's probably got another job. So you got to do everything. So it's just balancing stuff and not, there's no excuses in that stuff, right? Like you got to kind of make it happen. Like if you're doing game ops and, you know, you forgot a pylon for football, like you got to figure it out. You know, I think that stuff is really, important for, you know, moving forward in your career.
What do you think makes a good assistant? Since you served as an assistant in a couple of different programs, when you think about, you know, you've also obviously been a head coach now. When you're looking for an assistant, or when you think about what makes a good assistant coach, what are some of the qualities that you develop and that you now look for in people who are going to be an assistant in the program that you're leading?
I think it's interesting. Like being an assistant coach is very kind of thankless, or you think it's thankless. I think, and this is the hardest thing to find, is someone. A lot of people say that they want to coach basketball, but I don't think a lot of people know what that means. I think a lot of people say they want to, you know, do it, and they kind of do the minimum, and they don't necessarily do whatever it takes to get the job done in terms of staying late. You know, we all want to cut film, we all want to recruit, but we don't all like want to order meals after the game, or, you know, have to drive players to the airport at 4:30 in the morning or whatever. And those are things that your head coach may not find out you didn't do, but I always thought that those were just kind of part of the job, right? I think the first thing is being hardworking. I think especially at the lower levels, like your boss can teach you how they want certain things done in terms of on the floor, and things like that. So definitely kind of acumen and picking stuff up quickly. And then I think the third thing, for sure is the ability to multitask and be kind of a chameleon in different social situations. I think if you're going to recruit student athletes, you need to be able to kind of convey your message to different students, right? It's not always the same kind of kid. And I think those are the best, in my experience, both from having my students be recruited, but also recruiting students, those are the best recruiters, are the people who are kind of social chameleons.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the recruiting piece of it. When you're out on the road recruiting, what are things, and we can kind of, I guess, disassociate the level, but let's focus kind of on the intangible piece of it. What are some things when you walk into a gym and you're scouting a kid and you're looking to decide whether or not this is a kid you want to bring into your program? What are some of the intangible things that you look for that are important to you when you're trying to evaluate, is this kid going to be a good fit?
I think there's obviously physical stuff. I think the first thing that I look for is positional size. I think if you're obviously big for your position, that makes a big difference. And that's different at every level, right? Like I think at high school, big for your position at the center spot, it might be 6'7" or 6'8", depending on your level, it might be 6'6", right? I think that's important. I think the ability to shoot the ball is always welcomed. I think with the, you know, the advent and the advancement of the game, I think that's becoming more and more important. And then the third thing is kind of like, what else do you do, right? Like, I think we all talk about kids that play hard and they're coachable and all that stuff. But the thing is, like, at most of these levels, if you don't do some of those things, like, you don't really last, right? Like, if you don't, if you're not coach, if you don't, if you're not coachable, there's a lot of kids who play basketball, right? Like, we'll just go find somebody else. I think that that's what not a lot of coaches tell their players is, you know, you cannot listen, or you can do this, or you can do that. And we can have a different conversation about what body language, how important that is or isn't. But like, if you're just not going to listen and not do what we're trying to do to get us to win, then we'll just go get somebody who will do those things. And then, you know, playing hard is a skill. I think we've all learned that, and guys get paid obviously at the highest level, not just because they play hard, but I think in addition to playing hard, I think Marcus Smart just signed a big deal, and that's a big piece of what he does. And obviously he's physically gifted, but I think those are always things too that stand out. But I know a lot of kids who get recruited at a high level that don't play very hard. So I think that's just coach speak that we say to make ourselves feel better.
Well, I love that, because to me, it just seems obvious that if you come into our program and you're not going to do the things that we need you to do, hopefully you can identify that before you bring the kid in, which is clearly what you're trying to do, so that you don't have any of those kids that become a part of your program. But to your point, what a great message to send to players. And it's too bad that there's so many players who don't get that message for whatever reason. And we could go into what those reasons are and whether or not how coaches are incentivized or not incentivized to tell their players what the truth really is. But if you could just have that conversation with every player, like, look, you have to be able to do what your coach of your program wants you to do. And that may not always be hoist up 25 shots a game. There may be other things that your coach needs you to do. And it's such a simple message. And yet at the same time, I think it's one that players don't hear enough. And it's probably one that coaches don't say enough, because to your point, there's so many players out there. Like, I look at the recruiting piece today, and I don't know, it just seems like when I go watch basketball, I'm trying to determine this kid's potential versus this kid. Like, there's so many kids who are skilled. And I guess for me, what it would come down to, when I walk into a gym and I sit down and watch a game, and you'll know exactly what I'm saying once I say it, it's like, there's a kid who can play, and then there are kids who are playing basketball. And if you really find a kid who can play, those kids stand out like sore thumbs. And again, then part of it depends on what level you're recruiting for. Obviously, if the kid's athletic and 6'8", then he's probably being recruited by Division I's. If he's 6'1" and he's a little bit slow, then maybe he's being recruited by Division III schools. So it just kind of depends. But I think we all, people who know basketball and watch a lot of basketball, you can identify, like, that kid's a basketball player. And I think it goes to what you said. Are you doing things that impact winning? Do you play hard? Do you share the ball? Do you play on the defensive end of the floor? Or are you just looking to shoot? And is it all about you? And so often, you just see so many environments with basketball where kids are doing things just for themselves. So when you are sitting there and you're watching that game and you're looking at a kid and you're trying to decide, is this kid going to be a fit for us? And then you get to have an opportunity to have a conversation with him or his family. What are those conversations looking like? And what do you try to discern from the discussions and the conversations that you might have with the player during that recruiting process?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and it differs, right? I think when you're at, you know, some of the places I've been, like Colby Sawyer, a lot of it was trying to get as big of a funnel as you can with kids that you think can help you. Because that's a school, you know, it's a very specific school, right? Like it's very small, it's liberal arts. You know, it's a great program. The coach actually just left to take an AD job, but he had won close to 500 games. Like he was phenomenal, but he liked a very specific kind of kid. Like, he liked the tough, hard nose, got to be able to get coached. So, like, if a kid was, for instance, like if the parents spoke for the kid a lot, or like if the kid kind of was an excuse maker, if that makes sense, like, this isn't going to work out. You know what I mean? Right. Like, Coach Foy's going to tear you up. Like, you're not going to last. So, we're just not going to even pursue this. You know, and then there's places like Bates where, like, you know, it's a good school. It's a high academic school. There's a finite amount of students that can get into a school like that. So, you know, they're all being recruited by the same people. So that was like, let's go find a different kid, a kid from out of region, a kid that nobody knows about that fits what we want and how we want to play. But I think from a personality standpoint, you're always looking for kids that you enjoy being around, families that you enjoy being around.
Are you tired of slipping and sliding on the court and sticky sheets just aren't giving you grip? Grip Spritz solves this problem without having to lick your hand to clean your shoes. Grip Spritz is used by countless AAU, high school and college programs, semi-pro teams, as well as NCAA athletes and G League players. Unlike other products, Grip Spritz has solutions for individual players, not just entire teams. We've used Grip Spritz at our Head Start basketball camps and players love it. To keep you and your team from slipping and sliding, visit gripspritz.net to learn more.
I do watch the parents. I think that's important. If a dad or a mom is too involved, that doesn't necessarily turn me off, but I think it's the question is now me as a head coach, can I manage this parent? I think that's really important. Like, is this guy going to sit or this mom going to sit down when I tell her to sit down and like not meddle in what we're trying to do? Because I think some of the most important parenting conversations parents can have with their kids is after the games. It's either like your pro coach or your anti coach. And that seems to be kind of, you know, the way it goes.
It's so true. That's so true.
So, I mean, I think you got to want to like the kid. The kid's got to be into what you're doing, right? Like, and I try to get as many kids on campus as I can, obviously. But then I also try to get as many kids to come to practice as they can. So, like, I'm not saying I wouldn't take a kid if he hasn't come to practice, but I haven't taken very many kids that haven't come to practice, because if you can't deal with this directness, if you can't practice hard for 2 hours, if you can't, like, if this doesn't kind of get your motor going, like, this probably isn't going to work out and it's going to be more trouble than it's worth. And that's, you know, no matter how good you are, I think, like, that's kind of one thing I've always, I guess, prided myself on is, like, you know, I feel like I can win with a lot of different players. And obviously we're all in the market for really good players, and next level players help you really win. And that's who actually wins games. But I feel like there's a lot of them out there. And we can win a lot of different ways with the guys that want to be in your program.
I think it's a good way to look at it when you think about just the sheer volume of kids that are out there and how much skill level there is in today's player compared to, you think about when you were playing, or certainly when I was playing back a long time ago, there just wasn't as many kids that were as skilled. The kids today can do so many more things with the ball, and so many more of them can shoot the ball. And so I think your point is well taken, that there's not just one perfect player that fits your program. You can find somebody and hopefully mold them. And if they have a certain level of skill and they have the academics and they fit in with the school environment and they're coachable, then you could probably make that situation tenable for them and make it so that you can excel with the team that you have in front of you.
Yeah. I mean, not to cut you off, I haven't been a head coach at the college level, but I would say that's definitely true in high school. I think at Phelps, when I first got there, I thought the answer was to like pump it full of post grads and just be you know, the hungry dog team and you know, have a bunch of kids that just they're chasing scholarships and their last chance and this, that, and the third. And I think that there's a piece of that that's important, and that's a balance. Then we went and played Blair, right? Academy, Joe Mantegna, you know, obviously prep school legend. They beat us by like 40. And I had never seen a warm-up like I saw. And that's one big thing with me is like, I hate bad warm-ups. It has to be a certain way. And they had the most impressive warm-up I think I've ever seen. And, you know, we developed a relationship. I asked him, I said, how do you get your kids to do that? And he's like, I've had them for 3 years. I don't take 1 year kids. I don't take 2 year kids. Like, I don't care how good they are. This is how we do it. And I just, at that moment, I was like, you got to get them young and you got to get a certain kind of kid and you just got to make them good. And I think, you know, that's definitely carried over with me. And I think that's a big part of my coaching philosophy now. Like, I, you know, not to say I wouldn't take a 1 or 2 year kid, but I think the younger you can get them and the better, quote unquote, trained they are to play the way that you want to play, I think the more kind of congruent they are with you.
No, that makes a ton of sense. All right, I have two questions from what you just said. First one is, all right, you're a big warm-up guy. So what's a good warm-up look like? Because we've all seen different levels of, I'm going to call it seriousness when it comes to warm-ups. So what makes a good warm-up and why is that so important to you? And then I'll come back to my second question.
I think the first and foremost thing is like the guys have to be going at game speed. I think, you know, it's hard to do it for 20 minutes. Like, let's not lie. So maybe we have to cut the warm-up down a little bit. Maybe we don't warm up at the 20-minute mark. Maybe we do it at 15 or 18 because they've all been out there. They're all kind of loose. You know, we go back in and talk, whatever it is. I think the first thing is they're going game speed and they're going hard, right? They're talking, they're vocal, they're getting mentally engaged. So now you're physically engaged, you're verbally engaged, and hopefully you're mentally engaged. And I think a lot of kids worry about burning out, right? They worry about, like, I don't want to get tired. Like, I can't tell you the amount of times I've heard that. And it's like, well, dude, like, you're supposed to be in shape. If you're not in shape in the middle of the season, when are you going to be in shape, right? So, like, you should be sweating, right? So, like, you come out, you actually have a sweat going. Right. 2 minutes comes in, we bring it in, you get a little sip, get your second wind, and like you're ready to rock. You know what I mean? I think whatever you do to make that happen, I think we all have different ways of doing that. But, you know, mentally, verbally, and physically engaged, and that you actually have a kind of full on sweat going, I think is the kind of the main indicators.
What's your favorite warm up drill / activity? Something that you can explain in an audio podcast quickly.
I mean, we do a full court thing. I think, like, especially at the start of practice, and we'll for pre-games, we'll kind of condense it to half court. But, you know, we'll run, we have a ball, like we'll sprint, dribble, then we'll kind of change direction and just kind of get them going, you know, kind of do a dribble map. So up to the elbow, over to the sideline, up to half court, if it's pre-game, dribble all the way across. We'll hit a manager and then we'll kind of go in for a layup. So we'll do 3 layups, 3 pull-ups. And 3 threes. And that just kind of gets them going. If you do a full court pre-practice, it really kind of gets them. Sometimes we'll do it with a heavy ball, which really, really helps. So that kind of gets them going. And, you know, when they pass it to the manager, they have to say the manager's name. And it kind of gets them, like, loose to go into the next thing. And it doesn't take very long.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that warm-up, one of the things that I always find to be super interesting about the AAU basketball, youth basketball space, like as a coach, I intuitively understand exactly what you're trying to get accomplished, where you're getting your players physically, mentally, emotionally ready to play a game. And then I think about the poor AAU coach whose team comes out onto the floor after being cramped up in some hallway and walks out on the court and there's 3 minutes put up on the clock and then the buzzer buzzes after 30 seconds and, you know, you maybe took one shot and you're trying to do something and all of a sudden you're back trying to play. It always strikes me whenever I'm coaching at that level and I get involved in those tournaments and you see I'm like, this might be one of the worst things for basketball players to be actually ready to play, both from a physical standpoint, just being loose and warmed up. And obviously you try to do stuff if you can find some space off the floor and in a hallway or out in the lobby or whatever. But nonetheless, I just always think that, man, it would be so nice to go back and, you know, think about what we did when I was an assistant high school coach. And just, again, you're trying to get your players ready to play like you described. And in so many instances in grassroots basketball, like it's not even possible So it's, I think it's something that's underrated. If you utilize your warm-up time, you know, again, that's 15 or 20 minutes, whatever it is, that you can not only get your players warmed up for the game, but you can make them better at the same time. Yeah. If you're doing things that, you know, impact and, you know, again, hopefully it should be things that reflect what they're going to do in the game, which is what you should be doing in practice anyway. It's an extra 15 or 20 minutes of practice time every game, however many games you have on your schedule. So I think a lot of coaches could probably do a better job of taking advantage of that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to, like with everything, is explain to them why the warm-up's important and kind of sell it to them, right? Like you don't go into X thing without warming up for it. Like this is the same thing. Like, you know, we have a chance here to kind of jump, because if they're not warming up, like we're warming up, like we've given ourselves an advantage. And a lot of basketball, especially when you get into conference play, whether it's in high school or in college, like there's not a huge gap between the teams and the teams all know each other. So any kind of advantage you can gain, whether it be through the warm-up or through scouting or whatever, like that helps you win the game. And I think conveying how important that is to them and why it's important hasn't really helped me very much, but I hope it helps somebody else.
Well, it's funny because that why is – we hear so many coaches talk about that today, that sharing the why is so important to get that player buy-in. And I always hearken back to when I was a player – and I don't think I necessarily ever asked the question. Well, I certainly didn't ask it out loud of a coach. I don't think I asked my coach one question about what we were doing. You just kind of did what you were told. And obviously it's a different era today. But I think that why piece is critically important, because there's so much information out there that kids, parents, people who are involved in your program, they want to know the why behind it. And as a coach, I think it helps you to think about the why behind what you're doing, which goes back to that second question that I had a few minutes ago, which is how long into your career was it before you had solidified what your coaching philosophy was, or the way that you wanted to play, or the way you wanted to do things? And again, I know you're ever changing and evolving and growing and learning, but when you really started to narrow down and say, these are the core things that I believe in, how long into your career was it before you started to really get a grasp on what it was that you believed in, both whether it's offensively, defensively, culture? How long did that take?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I think I'm still kind of we're coming up on my third season as a head coach. I think you know, you're always kind of trying to figure out what that is. I would say, and I used to say this in recruiting at the school I was at before, and I continue to say it. I think my first season, I thought I was okay, but my second season, I knew so much more. So, like I used to say, like this team is getting an infinitely better coach than last year's team is getting. So to answer your question, I think I'm still doing it. I mean, I think I have a way that I think ideally I want to play. Like everyone wants to play fast, everyone wants to shoot threes, but I think so much of what I try to do is like, let's get, you know, the right people, the right shots at the right time. And it's not, you know, an equal opportunity thing. And it might not be, you know, the way that other teams do it in terms of our sets or anything like that. But I think definitely offensively, I like to liken it to the spread offense, right? In football, everything looks the same until it's not. So like we have different calls off of our offensive stuff, so we'll call it all the same package. We'll have different packages, and then like one word is different, so we'll say like, you know, formation, set, play kind of thing. And it's hard to scout, and you don't know when it's going to come or anything like that. So I think that's it offensively. And defensively, I'm still playing around with stuff, right? Like I think I definitely have thought I wanted to play zone for a long time, and we did it this past year, and I really liked it. So I think, you know, or zone program, I think officially, I think it's that's defensively what I want to do. And I'm continuing to work on the rotations of that as well.
All right, let's go back to offense and we'll jump over to defense. So when you think about that style of play that you described, when you break that down in practice, what does that look like in terms of drill work, how you set that up? Are you setting up the different actions and working on those in isolation? Is it break it down first and then put it into the whole picture, or are you the whole picture first and then break it down in the parts? Just what's your approach from a practice standpoint teaching it to your players?
Our practices don't vary too much, and I think that's something that the longer your season is, probably the worse that is. I think like one thing that I probably like project to my kids too much is like, I like to know what stuff looks like. So like if I go into a meeting without an agenda, like I have like a panic attack. I don't know what's coming. Right. So like I tell the kids, like, I'm not very smart. Like our practice is going to be structured pretty much the same way every day. Like there's going to be different stuff that we do in terms of like the actual execution of it. But like, you know that we're going to shoot before we warm up, and then, you know, we're going to warm up, and then, you know, we're going to do defense. Right. Like it's all kind of the same. So like, I teach a lot of decision making. I think that's something that's really important and something that's really undertaught. Like basketball is such a fast game that you have to be able to make the right decision at the right time. Right. So we do a lot of like advantage, disadvantage, or, you know, offensively specifically, like we'll go into whatever an initial action is. And then, okay, we're going to go right in the ball screen and like they're going to be in this coverage or that coverage. And you have to have the answer to that pick and roll coverage. And, you know, if we're coming up in a game and we know this team's going to blitz us, like we'll work on the blitz coverage for, you know, however many days we have to do it. And then we'll play. We play a lot of 5-on-5. We play a lot of 3-on-3. I just think decision-making is really important, especially at the high school level, because they don't have kind of the background knowledge to just walk through stuff like you can at some of the higher levels.
I agree 100% on the decision-making piece of it. That's one of the things that I think – we talked a little bit earlier about how skilled kids are. And I do think that if you look at a roster at the high school level today, the number of kids who can shoot it and put it on the floor and handle the ball, especially when they're in isolation, is way, way, way higher than it was 10 or 15 years ago. And yet I'm not sure that the basketball IQ and decision-making, that the improvement there has matched the improvement in skill level. So when I hear you talking about playing advantage, disadvantage, and putting kids into the situations that they're going to see, whether it's pick and roll coverages or whatever it might be, how do you parse out making the decision of when to correct, when to ask a question? How are you coaching that decision? So I know coaches always kind of struggle with, how much do I stop the action when I see a decision that maybe was made incorrectly versus I let it play out and then we come back to it, or I let the kids play it out and they see that, okay, here's the decision they made and it was a bad one, not because the coach gave me feedback, but because it was a turnover and then I've got to make a different read the next time. So how do you actually teach or talk about with your players the decisions that they're making on the practice floor?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's probably the biggest area of growth I've had as a coach. I think like we want this perfect symphony and we want like a Hamilton play production of basketball, and like that's not really how it is, right? Like it's a game of chaos, and depending on how fast you play, right, it's and what level you coach, honestly at high school, like sometimes it's a game of errors, right? And I think minimizing those errors is really important, and giving the kids what to expect in certain coverage. I think we're a really heavy pick and roll team. I think we'll continue to do that at St. Andrews, but a lot of that is just teaching them the decision to make against a certain read. So we do that through film work. We watch a lot of film, and it's not a lot in terms of the volume at one time. Like we're fortunate if it's in Andrews, like we have TVs in the gym. So like I can airplay my laptop onto the TV, you know, mid practice and say like, hey, listen, there's your read. Where should you go with it? Okay. The kid answers it right or wrong. Right. And you can correct it. I try not to stop practice too much. I just think that kills the flow of it, especially if we're in kind of mid flow, but there's a balance, right? Now, like I'd be lying if I said I perfectly figured it out, but we use a lot of, a lot of film, a lot of like, okay, here's what to expect, especially if we're scouting an opponent, but a lot of it is just kind of, you know, do it on air, do it kind of like with an advantage, and then do it live. I think that's been really successful for us.
What's your process for preparing film for those kinds of situations like you just described? Is that something that you personally are doing and breaking it down? How do you go about breaking down the film? How much film are you watching? Just describe your process for utilizing film to what you feel is the best of its, of its ability.
Yeah, I think I've definitely, that's another area. Like I've been able to work a lot smarter than necessarily harder. So like when I was an assistant in college, I'd watch as many games as I could, especially my first job. So at Colby Sawyer, like all I did was watch film and recruit. like, I didn't really have a hand in planning practice because, you know, the coach has done it. He's done it for 30 years. Like, he's going to – he can figure it out, right? Like, so I would just watch film, recruit, watch film, recruit. He did most of the scouts. And then as I kind of progressed through that year, we kind of started to collaborate on stuff. But I didn't want to have – not have an answer to what that team was doing if he asked. And sometimes he asked and sometimes he didn't. But I tried to watch as much as I could. And then when I got to Bates, the way that that league is set up, it mirrors the Ivy League. So you play Friday night, Saturday afternoon. So if you're going to watch, you know, six games of each team, like, that's really hard, right? Because that's 12 games,
right? Exactly.
In 3 days, because you can't prep on Thursday for you know, Saturday. You got to prep for Friday. So you got to kind of really grind it out. And we had synergy there, and that really helped, obviously. But I also really like to watch kind of the full game just to get the story of the game, right? The picture of the game. So, you know, I'd watch a lot, and then, you know, we'd parse it up, and I'd lead the scouts a lot of times. And I you know, I kind of was like, maybe I'm giving these guys too much, and it ended up probably being the case. And then Phelps, you know, I watch every practice at Phelps, and I'd watch as much film as I could. Like, there's not the true film exchange in high school. Like, I mean, I don't know how it is in Ohio, but, like, I'd have to grind it out to find film and look at YouTube and call people. And, you know, sometimes I only got two games, you know, at the end of the day. So, like, you got to kind of figure it out. So a lot of that was a lot more about what we're doing as a team, you know, because most high school teams only have one or two pick and roll coverages. So you can kind of figure that out. But I'll do it during practice, to answer your question. Finally, I will show it during practice, or we'll have a TV that I can airplay my computer to on the practice floor. And, like, it may be, you know, pre guardum segment or pre, you know, after shooting or something like that at some point during practice, just to keep them engaged. I make them stand up. And then for scouts, we'll do it, 2 days before the game. And then we'll do a personnel edit kind of right before. So I think my job as a high school coach, especially at a college prep program, is to try to get them as ready for college as I can. And part of being ready for college is digesting film and digesting scouts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that I hadn't really seen very much of, actually utilizing practice film on the floor where the kids are, whatever, they're engaged or doing something, and you show it to them beforehand or afterwards, whatever, and they're seeing it right there in the moment, and then they go and then they have to execute it. They have to learn from the film in the practice setting. And when you think about the way that kids consume media today, right? I mean, the amount of time that they spend watching YouTube videos or TikTok or whatever it is, I mean, and the ability to just, let's take it even a step further. Like, you're doing a player development workout. You just take your phone out with you on the floor and you're like, okay, we're going to work on this move, and you just pull up some NBA guy that's doing a particular piece of footwork or whatever, and then you can show it to that player. And I think it's amazing what you can do with some of the technology and some of the tools that we have. And it's just one more thing. I mean, I think it's, I equate this a lot to being a teacher. Teachers, you get so many things kind of thrown at you. I think that, hey, try this, do this, and there's Google Classroom this, and all these different tools and suites and things that you can do. And it's like you have to find one or two of those things that you can really be good at that you can utilize. And it sounds like you found the ability to be able to incorporate and bring the film that you've cut up and that you've looked at, and you know what you want to show them, and then be able to show it to them in the practice environment. And it just adds to their ability to see, because you can stop it, you can see it, and you can look at it a couple times. Whereas if you just stop a drill in practice and you say, hey, that decision was wrong, well, the kid can't see it. He can't go back and look at it. Whereas if you have it on film, obviously you can go back and you can look at it a couple times. You can say, hey, what were the options? Like, what could this player have done in this situation instead of the choice that he did make? And I think that that's really got to be a tremendous tool for coaches that are utilizing it. I don't know that a lot of people are bringing the film onto the practice floor. I don't know how many people you've talked to, but there's only one or two that I can think of that I've had conversations with that are actually bringing the film onto the practice floor.
Yeah. I mean, I stole that. They do that. I saw it in the NBA. Like, they did it in the NBA. And I've always kind of said, like, well, if they do it, we can kind of figure out a way to do this. So, like, at Phelps, we didn't have a big staff. I had one manager, dynamite manager. But I didn't need him filming, right? So, like, we'd set the camera up and we'd only film half the court. So, like, if the play happened on the other half of the court, like, sorry, dude, we can't get that one. So we'll go look at this one. But at St. Andrews, we have Huddle like in the sky. Like, I don't even know what it's called, Huddle Cam or whatever.
That's right, like the thing that's mounted on the ceiling.
Yeah, so you can do it from your phone. So I'm really looking forward to that because it's, you know, you can process the film in real time and we can kind of, you know, I'll teach Amanda how to use it. I've already kind of started to brainstorm some of that stuff. So I think that's going to be even more helpful because I think one thing, and I tell this to the players and the parents, like in the mid preseason, like you're either going to read it, you're going to do it, or you're going to see it. But like, there's no excuse for you not to learn something if we're trying to teach it, because we don't do a lot of stuff. Like, I think that's really important too, is like, we don't have, you know, 15,000 different calls that we're going to run. You know, this set looks different than that set. Like, and I say it all the time, like, I'm not very smart, right? Like, there's only a finite amount of things I can do, and we're just going to be really good at what we do. And like, you know, you guys can know what's coming, but you can't do it the way that we do it. And I think that's really important for me as a coach, right? To not have 5 million different calls in my brain. Like, okay, this is what we need to use in this situation. Like, let's just do it till they stop it, you know?
I love that. That's the philosophy that I've always had from way back when I started, was if we're good at what we do and we worry about what we do, it makes what the other team does to us or against us less important if we can execute whatever it is that we're trying to do. Again, forget about what the specific philosophy or set play or offense or whatever it might be. If you just can execute what you do, it makes what the other team does less important. And I think that, again, if you're spending time with your own team and trying to get them to execute to the best of their ability, a lot of the problems that opponents can present to you, again, presuming that the talent level is similar, a lot of that can be mitigated just by your ability to execute if you're focused on what you're trying to do. Let's talk a little defense and zone. Why zone? Give me the sales pitch for why you think zone is the best way for you to play.
It's funny. So Tom, the guy I keep talking about, he for the longest time has been like, gotta play zone, man. Gotta play zone. Takes all this guesswork out of it. He's like, you know, you can go on Twitter and see 5 million man-to-man sets, right? Like, you can go, like, just go talk to Zach Bovaire, and it's like he can give you a million of them off the top of his head. But there's only a certain amount of spots that guys can go when you play zone. And if you play a unique zone, so like we play 1-3-1, right, there's different kind of avenues that you can do things out of, and it's kind of doesn't always look the same, and you can kind of play with the drops and things like that. So I think, you know, that's something. I don't want to give away all the trade secrets there, but it's, you know, that's kind of it, right? So like it's, you know, it's less of guesswork, and we're not too like, you know, disguising things just yet. I mean, I got to teach it better, to be honest with you. I think, you know, I kind of threw it in midway through last year just because I was like, you know, this year doesn't really count. We're going to play games. Like, I might as well just see what works and what doesn't. You know, and I think the principles stayed the same, right? Like, you got to be able to guard the ball. You got to be able to kind of move on airtime, and you got to be able to take away certain things. But I think zone also allows you to actually guard the 3-point line better because you have built-in help, right? So like, if our best thing is to take away, if the thing that we want to do the most defensively is take away 3 and rim, right? I think this is just me. I think it's a lot easier to close out in a zone, right, than it is a man. And then you have built-in help if you play it the right way. So, you know, it's just kind of making people take shots they don't want to take, because we want to take the shots that we want to take that we think are good shots, and we want you to take shots you don't want to take that aren't good shots for you, right? So that's just kind of how I thought about it.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think the other thing that gives you an advantage as a team that plays zone is that most teams, maybe they're not full on 100% of the time man-to-man, but you can guarantee that coach has a man-to-man defense that they've worked on. And you think about trying to prepare for a team that, as you said, plays maybe a unique zone. Well, in order to be able to go against that in any way, shape, or form, you have to first teach your second team how to play that zone. And you're obviously not going to be able to do that in a day or two of practice the same way that your team's going to be able to do it, practicing it all year and having it be your base defense. And I think there's an advantage there just in the uniqueness of a team not seeing that kind of zone. Just makes it more difficult to prepare for you. It's kind of like what the Navy and the wishbone, right? The military academies in football, right? You don't see anybody playing the wishbone. So now you go and you play against them. And even though you might have superior athletes and be a better team, it it's difficult to play against because you're just not, you just don't see it very often. I think that's one of the advantages of zone as well, for sure.
Well, what do they say, right? Slow mind, slow feet, right? And I think one thing that really kind of sold me too, and I kind of was on the fence about it, and then Merrimack, so Coach Hamill retired, and a new guy, Joey Gallo, took over, and he plays zone. And, you know, I went to their practice. It might have been his first practice as a coach or second practice as a coach at Merrimack, and they started kind of doing their breakdown stuff. And, you know, I was asking, I'm really, really close with their assistant. I'm like, you know, like, what? He's like, dude, this thing's going to be crazy. And they just do it so well, and they're so well trained. And his thing is, we're going to be the best trained team at what we do. Right. And I think that there's a lot of value in that too. So like, he doesn't try to disguise, like, we're going to play 99% possession of zone. So I also think, and this is just me, if you're going to be a zone team, like, you have to do it. You can't be, you know, oh, we're going to play 60 possessions of zone and 40 possessions of man. Cause then that's kind of like having two quarterbacks, right? You don't have one.
Right.
And I think that that's the way that I look at it. Like, and it's really important because it's hard to teach. And I found it to be much harder to teach than man-to-man because I think there's this built-in, like, I can kind of chill, right, on the backside that a lot of kids have that they don't necessarily have in man because, like, you know, and he says this too, Joey says this too, like, you know, you have to know whose fault it is in order to hold them accountable. And I think that's really important. And that's something that's a big offseason thing for me is like, okay, how did West Ham beat us or how did Perky Edmond beat us? Okay, like, that was his fault. Here's why, you know, like, just kind of doing that for myself. So that I'm a little bit more prepared to kind of put it in this year with our guys.
Well, there's just so many different things that can happen from an offensive standpoint against your zone where passes are made, guys penetrate, you get to certain spots on the floor where there's a question of whose responsibility is. You're kind of in that in-between, you know, those in-between spaces on the zone. And to be able to teach that and articulate it and give kids enough experience where – they know and they can make those reads. Just like you talked about reads in a pick and roll, you have to be able to make those reads and those decisions on the defensive end of the floor when you're in a zone because you have to know, okay, ball gets here and who's the closest man, whose responsibility is, do I have to bump a guy off? How do I rotate out of that position when it's not, you know, I'm covering for somebody else? And so there's so many different scenarios. That's what I always find that is difficult for me from a zone standpoint is – kids will start asking questions. Well, what if this and this and this happens? And again, part of that answer is, well, you just got to play. I mean, we can put you in position, and ultimately it comes down to, I'm not out on the floor. You have to make reads, but you have to give kids the experience so that they can start to recognize those scenarios. And I think that sometimes is what coaches find to be a challenge when it comes to playing zone. And that's, as I said earlier, to me, that's the advantage. If you're going to be a zone team as a high school team, that teams just don't see it and they don't practice against it in the same number of reps that they do practicing against man to man. So it just kind of throws teams off. It gives them a little bit of an advantage. Let's talk about St. Andrews. Tell me a little bit about how the opportunity came to you when you get there and you look around. What are some of the things that you hope to accomplish as you start to build that program, you know, this coming season and on into what you've done so far this summer and where you're headed in the future?
Yeah, man. So it's all kind of go back. I had a really good situation at Phelps. I really enjoyed working there. You know, it was a lot, but I really liked it. I got a chance to coach some really good players, you know, nationally ranked players, high major kids, you know, high academic Division III kids. It kind of was the whole gamut. But, you know, I was kind of ready for the next phase of my life. So my girlfriend is also a coach. She's a field hockey coach. And she was a head field hockey coach at a Division III school, but we were living like 2 hours from each other. And it was a lot, right? Like, coaching's hard. It's, you know, it's a long hours, and in her sport's not any different than my sport. It's not like, you know, it's basketball. Like, they're the same thing. We both work really hard. And, you know, we kind of, the job came open and it was both jobs. And I honestly wasn't, I think a lot of people, I found that a lot of people are like, I'm trying to move to Austin. Like, it really wasn't like that for us. It just kind of worked out.
You weren't trying to get closer to the South by Southwest.
No, man, it's a great place, but that wasn't, you know, we weren't like, oh, this is a kind of a destination place. It just kind of worked out, man. And like the more, digging that we did into the school, the more time we spent with folks, both in upper administration and kind of the teachers, the more we kind of you know, we're sold on the place. I think there's three things that make this place really, really special. I think the community is phenomenal. That community you talk about that a lot of high schools lack, I think St. Andrews does it really well. You know, there's 980 kids K through 12. There's about 400 in the high school, but they are, it's one of the most impressive group of students I've ever been around. Like, they can have conversations with you, like articulate conversations. They're not afraid to advocate for themselves. Like, there's a lot of things like that that you really just kind of don't see. That was really impressive. I think the number two thing, and this is probably the most important thing selfishly, is like, they want to be good at athletics. I don't think they want to sacrifice, you know, the academics that they have, and it's an elite academic school, but there's a shared vision to be successful in athletics. You know, we're doing that in a lot of different ways. You know, they hired a bunch of new program directors, and that's kind of our role, right? Is we direct our program. So K through 12, we have a hand, or really are in charge and responsible for every facet of the program. You know, the coaches under you, the clinics you run, things of that nature. And then the third thing is, you know, it's a private school in the fastest growing city in America, which is really, really kind of exciting to be around. And it's, you know, you don't get this opportunity too often to kind of, you know, coach with someone that you're probably going to be with, you know, in the future. You know, I hope to make her my wife at some point and things like that. So it's really, you know, it's an exciting time for us both as a unit and moving forward in our life. But also, like, I mean, the school has just been super impressive with everything they've kind of been doing.
So as you look forward and you think about the task that you have in front of you, and you get to the end of this season and you look back, how are you going to define your success? What's going to make for a successful year for you and your team come next, whatever, April, May?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, it's been a program that's been pretty competitive. I think that's, you know, that is one good thing about this program, is we're known in Austin a little bit as being a competitive program. So, you know, the league is tough. So the league is comprised of, you know, honestly, probably the best schools in the state of Texas. So, you know, it's kind of unique. We travel for the conference games. We stay over in a hotel. We play Friday, Saturday. So it's kind of equivalent to the NESCAC in that mind. I think for us, like, you know, we just got to continue to build. Like, I've been able to get in a gym with a couple of the guys, and they're talented, but they're young, right? So, like, our best players are, you know, some of the younger guys on the roster. So just continuing to develop them. I'm very process driven. Like, I don't, you know, I'd love to say, like, I want to win 20 games. That might be realistic. That might not be. I'm not really sure. I just want to continue to see growth in them. And I think, you know, have it changed, like, the athletic culture a little bit. I think that's one thing about the school they've mentioned they didn't hide, was that, you know, we want kids to kind of be a little bit more into athletics. So I think you're starting to see that change. Like, we kind of took football on wholly. Like, we co-op with the school. Now we kind of do it ourselves. And there's the participation numbers for the fall sports are as high as they've ever been. So, you know, we're on the right track, I think. So just, you know, keeping kids, the culture, establish how we want to do things, play the way we're going to play, and kind of let the dice roll where they may.
It sounds like an exciting opportunity, not just for you, but obviously for your wife. And we know anybody who follows anything knows that Austin is a place where, as you said, a lot of people want to be. And the fact that you're able to come into St. Andrews and have the support of the administration, that they want to be able to have academic success, they want to be able to have athletic success, sounds like it's going to be a great fit for what you're trying to accomplish. I want to finish with a two-part question for you. First part of the question is, what, when you look forward, what's the biggest challenge that you see facing you to accomplish the success that you just talked about? And then number two, what's the biggest joy you have when you get up in the morning and you think, hey, I'm the head coach here at St. Andrews School? What's the biggest joy that you get from that?
So the first part, I think the hardest part is going to be educating. So, like, the way that St. Andrews is kind of viewed as, there's two parts, right? Either they can't afford it, which isn't true. People of Austin, we give tremendous financial aid. And the second part is, I can't get into that school, which is not true. It's a holistic review, right? Like, so I think we just have to educate people in the community, right, that you can be athletic and a good academic story here, right? That's possible. I think that's been a challenge so far. I think, you know, we can attract students from the area, but I think we've just got to kind of get our our willingness to be accepted of a lot of people out there. And you know, just building the foundation, I think it's not a school that's, and this is Texas, right, Mike? Like, this is like, you know, athletics are important. And they're important at the public schools and they're important at the private schools. And I think we're a little bit further behind than we would like to be. So just continuing to kind of get our name at, like, hey, we want to be good. And we're making strides to that. And then number two, I feel really fortunate to be at St. Andrews for a lot of different reasons, right? I'm not a private school kid. I didn't get to go to an education like this. Like, I never would have thought I'd gotten to work at a school like this. But I think I get to coach basketball for a living, right? I think at any level that you can get up and say, like, I get to coach a child's game and they're paying me enough for me to afford to live, you know, that's a win, right? I love being in the gym. There's access to the gym. The school's been great. I think I've been really reinvigorated since I've gotten here, and I think it's really been great.
That conversation, or that statement that you just made, harkens back to the beginning of our conversation tonight, right? With you going up in the attic and talking to your dad and asking him, hey, does Mike Krzyzewski make a living doing this thing? And so, you know, you take it full circle, and then your answer here at the end is basically the same thing, that, hey, I get an opportunity to coach basketball and I get a chance to make a living doing that. And the game, I say it all the time, and I know I'm not the only one who says it, but the game has been so good to me and given so much to me. And when we get a chance to talk to people like yourself on the podcast, who you can just tell through the conversation just how thankful you are for the opportunities that you've been given and what the game of basketball has been able to do for you. And to me, that's really, again, that's what it's all about. Whether you're hosting a basketball podcast like I am, or you're the head coach at St. Andrew's School in Texas, you're using the game of basketball to better the lives, hopefully, of the people you're interacting with. And that's really what it's all about. So before we get out, go ahead and share how people can reach out to you if they want to have a conversation, they want to learn more about you, they want to learn more about your program. You can just share social media, website, whatever you want to, how people can get in contact with you, email, and then I'll jump back in, Trey, and wrap things up.
Yeah, I think the best place to find me, to be honest with you, is Twitter, at Trey, T-R-E-Y, Morin, M-O-R-I-N. I am always on Twitter. It's probably my favorite social media platform. You can DM me, you can follow me. I'm always open to having conversations with people. I'm gonna plug myself here. I'm looking for an assistant coach in Austin. So if you're interested in helping us out, definitely reach out.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll put that on our Twitter account and certainly love put it in the show notes. So anybody who's out there, you're looking to, hey, there's a lot of people looking to move to Austin. Sounds like it could be a good gig in more ways than one, Trey. So
absolutely, man.
As I said off the top, this has been a long time coming, probably long overdue. So I can't thank you enough for taking the time to jump on with us tonight. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.